And our guest tonight, Robert Bavall, the Egypt Code. Fascinating information from Robert. We'll be back with him, and we'll talk more about the Giza pyramids and even his brother's thoughts that they were built by ETs. Robert Bavall. Robert, so you say there were some areas around the pyramid that seemed to be much, much older.
Yes. Let me just recap a bit.
Sure.
There are several other monuments than the pyramids on the Giza necropolis. The ones that I'm specifically referring to are the valley temples and the mortuary temples. They are deemed to belong, according to Egyptologists, to the pyramid builders.
And what are, and what are the valley temples, mortuary temples? What are they?
Okay. Well, basically, as the name implies, there are each pyramid had a temple nearer the Nile, down the valley. Hence, they're called valley temples. And almost butting the pyramid on the east side were the mortuary temples. Now, these are names given by Egyptologists, by the way.
Okay.
We have no idea whether they were mortuary temples or valley temples or what. And they were joined by a causeway. The only causeway that survives, there are two causeways that survive, the causeway of the middle pyramid, Khafra's pyramid, which joins the mortuary temple next to the pyramid to the valley temple below. And this one, this causeway, passes just next to the Sphinx. And there is a causeway also on the third smaller pyramid, which also has the remnants of the mortuary temple and the valley temple. Now, the mortuary temple of the large pyramid, the great pyramid, only the base, only the floor exists, and the valley temple has disappeared. Now, having said this,
okay,
when you approach the Giza necropolis, imagine you're coming face to face with the Sphinx. Now, for those who haven't been there, I'll describe it a bit, because it is quite an experience. I mean, as you enter that zone, you know, you really have to be a dead fish not to be affected. it's one of those things, and I'll use the words of my friend John West. You get a hit. You get hit by this place. You feel touched deep, and you're looking at something that shouldn't be there. It's kind of like a paradox. It's so alien. It's so different from anything you've seen. It shouldn't be there, and yet it's there. And your mind has to deal with this. It has to deal with the enormity of what you're seeing. And what it has to deal with is the mystery. We don't know when they were built. We don't know exactly who built them. We don't know why they built them, although I think I do. But there's huge questions that loom in your mind, because they're there, and they're so enormous, and they're so challenging to your mind. So that's the effect you get. And as you're entering, the thing that confronts you first of this place is the Sphinx. You're face to face with this stone sculpture, the face of a man, of a king, or a pharaoh, we're not sure. The body of a lion, enormous, size of a two-story block, 15 meters high.
That at one point was almost buried by sand, wasn't it?
It was buried by sand many times. If you leave the Sphinx unattended, it will get buried within 30 years. Only the head will stick out.
30 years, that high, okay.
Yes, that's what happens to the, because of the blowing sand. So in many ways, they had to constantly brush the sand away, because the Sphinx, as again some of your listeners may know, is lying, it's built out of the natural stone. It's not a built statue, it is a carved statue. It's literally carved from the natural stone there. And it is in a pit.
And who shot out the nose, Robert?
They say erroneously that it was Napoleon. This is the usual, but it isn't. We know from writings that have come from the Middle Ages, from the Arabs, that it was an Arab fanatic who wanted to spite the Sphinx. In those days, to spite your enemies, you cut their nose.
To spite themselves, yeah. Remember that saying?
That's right.
Yeah.
And therefore, he apparently went up there. I mean, there's a writing from one of the chroniclers, I'm not quite sure who, I think Marchesi, who mentions this man who actually went up there and with a spade or an axe chopped the nose off. In many ways, he gave the Sphinx this even more eerie look. You're looking at a very old statue there, hoary with age. It's defying your mind. I don't want to advertise my books, but if you read the opening lines of The Message of the Sphinx, which were written by Graham Hancock, by the way, he put it so well. You know, we're looking at something that's old and weather beaten and not of this era.
And you believe it's much older than the Giza pyramids?
Yes. I believe the Sphinx is much older. Yes, no doubt.
That could be 50,000 years old.
I don't know about 50,000, but it's definitely much, much older. And you sense it. You don't need to be a scientist. You don't need to be a geologist. It's just you sense it. It's one of those things. What you sense even more is when you look at those temples I've just described next to the Sphinx.
Why is Zahi Hawass so adamant, Robert, that it was the Egyptians who built all this? Is it pride? Is it public relations? Why can't he open up his mind and say it's conceivable, whether it's your brother's theory or others, maybe Atlanteans, that somebody else may have built this? Why won't he open up his mind to that?
Well, partly it's a national pride, of course.
Yeah.
Or I would say mostly in his case. And partly it's because it's the consensus among Egyptologists. I mean, there is a 100% consensus here. And those who oppose this or come up with another view. Now, I must say, speaking for myself, that I think the term Egyptian in itself is erroneous, because the Egyptians that we refer to as the Egyptians of today, the Egyptians of the pharaonic period, were not called Egyptians. You know, they were not Egyptians in the sense that that they held a passport saying, "I'm an Egyptian."
Right, right.
They called themselves the people of the Black Land, the Kemets. They did not see themselves as being of this zone. I mean, the pharaonic dynasties believed emphatically. Now, whether you believe it or not yourself is another matter, but they believed that they came from the sky. I mean, there is no doubt in the understanding of the ancient texts that they believed that they were descendants of a celestial pantheon
that visited here.
Well, what they say in the text is that they describe as creation, a bit like the Genesis of our Bible. I mean, there is a moment of creation where the world is created. They believe there was chaos and nothingness before. And then there was the primordial waters, and from the waters emerged the land. And then they believe that the first thing to appear was the sun, and hence the sun is the supreme manifestation of the creator. From the sun emerged a couple, known as Tefnut and Shu, the air and the moisture, which indeed is the primordial soup, if you like.
Yes.
And then from this couple comes the earth god. Geb, they called him. Incidentally, to the Egyptian, the earth was masculine rather than feminine.
And when do you think these texts were transcribed?
Well, they say that this is the moment of creation. I mean, the texts that we have come from the early dynasties, particularly the pyramid texts that I was referring to. But they, when I say they, the people who actually wrote them, believed that these texts referred to a moment of creation.
And it seems like it echoes Genesis pretty closely.
It does, yes. What it does echo to me is that in metaphoric language, they're describing the physical creation of our planet. I mean, indeed, there was the sun, and then we had the formation of the earth, the emergence of the land from the primordial soup, And then they say that from the second couple, the second generation, from the earth and the sky goddess, came four gods, four human figure gods, two of which were Osiris and Isis, the first couple, the first divine ruling couple. And they came down from the stars to populate the earth, and they were the first king and queen of Egypt.
Is this like the story of Adam and Eve?
In a sense, yes, but I don't want to shock anybody, but it seems to make more sense to me that they're describing something that is, in a sense, physically true in terms of cosmology. I mean, we know how the Earth was created.
Yes.
But we also know, in spite of the resistance to the idea, we are star stuff. We come from the stars. You know, and the other day I heard something quite fantastic. I mean, who used to say this all the time was Carl Sagan. I mean, he had this wonderful phrase.
Absolutely.
Saying, we are star stuff. We are the ashes of a long burnt star.
Well, the material in all our bodies, Robert, is 13 plus billion years old. Because matter doesn't go away. Matter just stays. We are stardust.
Well, we are stardust made conscious. I mean, we are stardust waking up, and it's a wonderful poetic way to describe it. But it's true. The other day, as you know, they were experimenting with a CERN accelerator.
Yeah, and wait till they really turn that sucker on.
We're going to find out certain things that are going to surprise us. However, one of the scientists, the British scientist, reminded us all. He said, "We're the ashes of a long burned star." I love this phrase. I mean, we come conscious. That's what we are, you know. And the Egyptians describe it in metaphoric terms. I mean, it's quite fantastic that they come up with the same imagery in metaphoric terms. And to me, this proves something that I truly believe in. I believe that there is another way of knowing. You know, we're in a culture that believes that the only way to know is through the scientific route. But scientific investigation as we know it has only been going on for 400 years or so. You know, we are endowed with many abilities, and one of the abilities is the intuitive ability. We can know without proving it,
yes,
if you see what I mean.
How do we explain these texts that talk about our arrival, basically, in Genesis, and how similar they are? What do you say about that?
Well, maybe you should talk to my colleague Ahmed Osman. I don't know if you know of Ahmed Osman.
I do not know him.
Sorry?
I don't know him.
Oh, he's an Egyptian writer who lives in London. He's very well known in this field. He's the man who began all these theories that Akhenaten was Moses and so forth. And he has recently published a book in the States. He has several books published in the States. One is called Moses and Akhenaten. I think it's published by Bear Publishers.
Okay.
He's a very, very good friend of mine. And, there's two ways to look at this. I mean, there is the idea that the biblical writers modeled their characters on the Egyptian history. And the other is that both writers of these texts, whether they are the biblical writings or whether they are the Egyptian ancient texts or indeed other writings, intuitively came up with the truth. You know, the truth is the truth. The truth is out there, if you like.
Now, let me ask you then your brother's theory to see how that matches some of the things you've just been saying. He believes in an extraterrestrial visitation and that we are they?
I'll rephrase that. He is open to the idea because some of his investigation forces him to look into that. And I think that's the right way to approach it. I wrote a book, as you may know, with Graham Hancock and John Grigsby called The Mars Mystery.
Yes, good book.
Yeah, and we were rather reluctant to write this book, I must admit, because it opened up the possibility that there were artificial structures on Mars. If Richard Hoagland is listening,
he's probably jumping up and down cheering for you right now.
Now, my view on this was that even on the chance that we're talking of a million to one chance, or whatever percentage you want to give it,
right,
we cannot ignore it. You know, it is not the right thing to do. So there is certain things in the pyramid structure, especially in the Great Pyramid, that forces you to consider another option, whether you like it or not. You know, it's one of those things. It's a bit like Galileo being dragged out of the Inquisition, and he's shaking his head and saying, I'm sorry, but it still turns.
Yeah.
You know, whether you like it or not. And it's one of those moments in everybody's life that you're confronted with an issue that you do not have an explanation for. And either you ignore it, which I think is wrong, or you're open to the possibility of something else. And that's what my brother is doing.
What about the possibility, and we'll get into the ET theory here for a second, but what about the possibility that our civilizations back about 10,000 or 50,000 years ago might have been so advanced, Robert, so technologically advanced, and somehow they blew themselves up, or they had a war, and they, you know, everything was destroyed. But is it possible that the technology that they had, which we still don't have, to build these Giza pyramids, must have been so advanced, but it wasn't extraterrestrial, but it was us?
I'm more inclined to look into that before I look into the extraterrestrials. Again, you know, all the options are open. I think we live in a time where we know certain things, that the options must be open.
But you don't believe that 100,000 slaves pulled these tons?
No, absolutely not. Well, incidentally, neither do the Egyptologists. I mean, the Egyptologists do not believe the pyramids were built by slaves, for one obvious reason.
But when I say that, though, I mean tugging and pulling these blocks into position. That's almost impossible, isn't it?
Well, some is possible. That's what I'm trying to tell you. I mean, if you study the Giza pyramids, you can explain some things. Other things, you are baffled. And I'm coming back very briefly to these mortuary and valley temples.
Okay.
What you can't explain in rational terms is that these temples are built with blocks that range between 50 and 200 tons. Now, let me give you an idea of what a 200-ton block looks like. It's the size, or it's twice the size of a locomotive. You know, it's an enormous block.
Huge.
It's, you know, you're looking at a block that's probably the size of your living room. It weighs 200 tons. Now, the minute you say this to a construction engineer or an architect, he's baffled because he says, well, why would they want to do that? Because it's much easier, much more practical, and even more structurally better to use smaller blocks. You know,
right.
The pyramids themselves are built with smaller blocks. So why would they want to build small temples? I mean, they're not very big temples. With these giant blocks, it doesn't make sense. I mean, it really doesn't. I mean, there is no rational explanation to it. And I know that some people have come up with rational explanation, but let me tell you, I'm a construction engineer, and if somebody would come to me and say, I want to build a house with 200-ton blocks, I'd call the psychologist.
Could we move a block like that today with conventional cranes?
We can, yes, we can.
There are cranes now that
can move, but I mean, they didn't have cranes, as far as we know. And, you know, we're told that they simply had brute manpower. They didn't even have the wheel. They didn't even have the pulley. They didn't have iron. So, you know, all they had was sticks and ropes and men.
And anything that heavy would get mired down in the dirt, wouldn't it?
Well, you know, It's when you look at the 200-ton block and you see it at an altitude of about 10 meters.
Hold on, Robert. Let's take this break and come right back to that. Well, next hour, we'll open up the phone lines with our guest, Robert Bovall, author of the latest book, The Egypt Code. We'll be back in a moment, though, and continue our discussion right here. Okay, Robert, you're an engineer. How do you think they move those stones?
Yeah, let me give you a little analogy here, George. So you... you really get the strangeness of this. Imagine a lady going out of her house and she wants to take her pair of gloves in her handbag, right?
All right.
Now, instead of doing that, she carries her wardrobe just to carry the pair of gloves. It doesn't make sense. So she's either mad or she's got an easy way to carry the wardrobe. You get my drift?
I get your drift.
And this is what we see with these blocks, is that they simply don't make sense. In order to build a temple of that size, they could have easily used blocks of about a ton. Already, that's already a big block, but to use 200-ton blocks is the equivalent of carrying your wardrobe just because you want to take your gloves. And therefore, we must come with an explanation. Apart from the difficulty of doing it, I really don't know how they did it. But the explanation is either they were mad, which I don't think they were, or they found it easy. We're trying to explain it in terms that do not fit what we see.
See, I don't even know how they would have cut the bottom out to pull it out of the ground. I just can't fathom it. I can't see it.
I mean, today I could do it, with the tools we have, with the facilities we have. But if I get a client saying, "Mr. Boval, I would like a 200-ton block," I would say, "Okay, fine." But then he says, "Hey, wait a minute. I don't want you to use any modern tools. I don't want you to use any iron tools.
And you have to cut it out of the ground or wherever it is.
Just with men and copper tools." You know, I would say, "Can't do it.
Can't do it." I mean, how do you think they would have cut the bottom of the block in order to lift it out?
Well, I'm telling you, what I'm about to tell you is the conventional way of explaining it. You know, that they cut the sides, and then they grappled on the block with ropes, and they yanked it out. But that's easily said than done. I mean, this is the problem with all these textbooks. You know, I was a very good friend of the world expert on pyramids, Sir Ivan Edwards, who wrote the classical book on pyramids. He was the curator of the British Museum. He died in 96, but we were very, very good friends at one time. And, in fact, he encouraged me to publish my books. And I remember discussing these matters with him, and he had written a section in his book about the construction of pyramids, and it was about something like 6 pages. You know, and I said, "Dr. Edwards, with all due respect, I mean, if I was to write a book, or my brother would be writing a book about the construction of the pyramids, mm-hmm. it would be about 3 volumes. You know, they explain it in simple terms, and that's it. You know, they say they move the blocks, and they cut the blocks.
Yeah, easier said than done.
Yeah, I mean, to an engineer, I mean, if the specifications and the instructions to bring a 200-ton block and lift it up 15 meters would require all sorts of organization and planning, and it's not
And how many of those blocks do they have, Robert, those big ones like that?
Well, I estimate about 300 of them on one of the temples alone. Most of them are between the 50 and 100 tons, but there are a few who go up to 200 tons. So, you know, it's one of those things that really, I mean, I take people there all the time, and when they look at these blocks, and when you point out what I've just pointed out, everybody's baffled. The only people who are not baffled are the Egyptologists. You know, it's one of those strange. They're the ones who should be baffled, because there is no rational explanation as to why they would want to do it. And then there is the great difficulty of actually physically moving these blocks. So here you are, you're an architect or an engineer, and you have to look at other options. And one of the options, which as disturbing as it may be to some people who would like not to think of these things, but one of the options is that it was easy for them. They somehow had an easy way of doing it. Now,
whatever it is,
we don't know. If that's the option that actually is the truth, then we're looking at the possibility that they had easy means to do it.
Could have been vibrational sound, which maybe just made
it
anti-gravity.
You,
who knows?
Yes, who knows? I mean, I think it's one of those that you have to leave with a question mark. I can tell you something, though. Because I'd like to bring the discussion to some new discoveries.
Which is your Egypt code.
Yeah, the Egypt code as well, yes. And beyond the Egypt code, because I'm also working on another book now, with an American astrophysicist called Thomas Brophy, whom you may or may not have heard of. Thomas Brophy wrote a book called The Origin Map.
Yes, the book I've heard of.
Right, and he'll be with me in Dubai. Thomas and I have just done an expedition a few months ago in April in the Sahara. And the reason we went there is to look at recent discoveries, which I will tell you in a short while, are about to change everything we know about ancient Egypt. But coming back to all this...
You've got to give me a little bit more, Robert.
I will in a minute.
Okay.
but coming back to this, We really have to have people who, like Galileo, like Newton, are ready to look into another alternative. You know, the apple fell, bricks fell.
In a dramatic alternative. Right.
Well, the question is, it's a bit like me asking why is the third pyramid offset? You know, first the question must be asked. Once you ask the question and have the courage to pursue it, then we get moving. And the trouble is that Egyptologists have not asked the questions. And some of the questions, they don't dare.
They don't want to, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you one of the questions that has been baffling everybody, the whole world, for the last 15 years, is what's behind those doors inside the pyramid? You know, of course, of this exploration.
Yes.
Well, for God's sake, I mean, 15 years we've been waiting.
Why haven't we gone behind the door?
Search me.
Or have they? Does Zahi already know?
I don't know. No, they have not. I can tell you.
Okay, and that's the same with the Hall of Records. They haven't found that, right?
Well, they won't look. I mean, that's the baffling thing.
I mean, there have been chambers that have shown up with special radio waves. We know there's something there, some kind of underground structure, but we don't go in there to find out.
Yeah, I mean, I've written a whole book about this.
Yeah.
In fact, I've written two books.
But you don't think Under the Cloak of Darkness... Zahi has gone there and has pulled out what could be in the Hall of Records.
No. There's no way you can do anything there without anybody knowing.
You can't put a big sheet over it or anything like that.
No. I have friends who literally live in front of the Sphinx. A very good friend of mine has a house literally in front of the Sphinx. I mean, you just can't go there and do anything. Besides, there is all the inspectors, and it's impossible to do. I mean, you can, inside the Great Pyramid, it's been suspected several times that they did perhaps explore the shafts more than we know. But I know for a fact, I mean, I'm very friendly with the new director of the pyramid area. Zahi Hawass is now the chairman of the
Antiquities. Yeah, he's in charge. And, Dodi Fayyad's brother wants us to do a program out there, a live radio show.
Dodi Fayyad?
Yeah.
Oh.
Out there. And I guess he lives right there.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Said he's
but
got a house in the shadow.
Let me know if you do that, because I've just come back from it.
Oh, I'm not going without you. No way. I'm not going without you.
Okay.
You will be there.
I was at Giza, literally, for the last 3 years. I mean, I rented an apartment overlooking the Great Pyramid. I mean, I was there. I mean, every time I went to my balcony, the Great Pyramid was there, you know? And I've just spent 3 years. So believe me, I know this site inside out, and I it's one of those places I've been studying for the last 30 years. I know everybody, I know the inspectors, I know the chief inspectors, and even though Zahi is I'm his nemesis. strange enough, I have a lot of friends in the antiquities that are mutual friends. So. You know, I know what's been going on there, and the door has not been opened.
What do you think could be back there?
Well, I mean, I've killed myself over the last 15 years. You know, I've looked at all the possibilities, and, you know, I tell you, here is one of those.
Is it a big chamber, do you think?
We don't know. So honestly, we don't know. But I'll tell you something about these shafts that a lot of people don't see it this way. But once you look at it this way, they're baffling. The shafts that were explored are the ones that are from the so-called Queen's Chamber. Now, I'll say immediately that we really don't know whether they were queens or kings or whatever. We call them such because they don't know what else to call them.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, the Queen's Chamber, which is the lower chamber, has these shafts, one pointing south and one pointing north. Now, I happen to have studied these shafts in the early 90s, and I was the first to publish their stellar alignments. And the reason, in fact, why I got so much involved with these, because Professor Edwards at the time asked me to go to Egypt to investigate the exploration that was going on almost in secret by the German Institute with a robotic machine.
How long is the shaft?
Well, the shafts go about 59 meters or so.
So that's a pretty good, that's 180 feet. That's a long way.
Yeah.
Okay.
But what is bizarre is the way that they were constructed.
Did a man have to go down the shaft were building these? Or did they fit in like a puzzle piece?
Yes, like a puzzle piece. They actually built them as they went along.
Okay.
But although the shafts, what you see when you look into the holes, you see an 8 inches by 8 inches hole.
All right, there's no way a man could squeeze in there.
No way.
A little tiny leprechaun or something.
Absolutely. But you know, as an engineer, I know that what you're seeing isn't at all the full construction of these shafts, because they're sloping upwards. That means you have to fashion all the blocks around them in order to cover them. It's a hell of a job. I mean, it's one big, difficult
job. Like a Rubik's Cube, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it is. You know, it's a bit like putting a chimney in a building, and instead of putting it straight up, which is very easy, you put it at an angle.
And you build around it.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to make a huge difficulty for the engineers, and that's what they did. I mean, they almost deliberately made it difficult for themselves. So obviously, these shafts were very, very important. The strangest of things is that not only there is the door at the end of it, but they were sealed. You couldn't see them from the chamber. I mean, you couldn't tell they were shafts. They were, in fact, discovered in 1872. So it's baffling. We really don't know what they were doing. I mean, it's as if they didn't want you to know that there were shafts in there, and yet they built them all the way to the chamber, and the last 4 inches they did not cut through. Nobody has come up with an explanation as to why they were doing this, you know. And one of the explanations, which is out of the ordinary, is that they wanted these shafts to be found. And yet they didn't want them to be found too easily.
Right away, yeah.
Yeah. Maybe, and that's what Graham and I toyed with, maybe they wanted them to be found when it was possible to enter them with something like a robotic machine.
Who would think of that?
Well, I'm saying it's a possibility.
Unless they had those kinds of machines at the time.
Well, the fact is that we did find them. And we found them in 1872, before, of course, such machine existed. But there they were since 1872, and there they stood unexplored till 1993, when Rudolf Ganterbrink went with his robotic machine.
Right, and didn't he drill through it?
No. They were cut open. When they were discovered in 1872, they were opened. Finally, we knew there were these shafts. What I'm trying to tell you is that from 1872 to 1993... the Egyptologists were not prompt to explore them. I mean, this to me is baffling.
Wasn't there a drilling that went on at the end of the shaft?
Yes, recently.
Yeah.
Okay, this is what happened. I mean, there was one or two attempts before Rudolf Ganterbrink to probe them with metal rods. They were done illegally. Some people went there, and they actually left the metal rods in there. That's what Rudolf discovered. We thought... At first, we were a bit excited because we thought, hey, metal, you know, but
we thought there were handles, didn't we?
Well, that's on the door. So when Rudolf took his machine all the way up the shaft and was able to video the door, what you could see was this. It was obviously some sort of trap door. You know, you could see the edges cut. The temptation was to lift it up. It was like a portcullis, you know, one of these old-fashioned doors. And on it were these two handles, or we call them handles, we really don't know where they are, made of metal, probably copper or brass. Now, totally baffling. I mean, it looks like the handles of a door. And there they were, and he was ready to open this door within days. I mean, he had no problem trying to open his door. What he was going to do was he was going to attach a flat metal piece on his machine so that it could slip under the opening, the bottom opening of his door. There was a couple of millimeters, about half an inch.
A little clearance there.
A little clearance. He could slip it and then try and lift this portcullis. And if he couldn't, then, of course, he would try and drill with a hole and put a fiber optic camera to have a look. Amazingly, I mean, at this 11th hour and 59 minutes, they stopped him.
Why?
Well, it's a long story, and you should read my book, Secret Chamber, but all sorts of political rubbish came up. I mean, they halted his work.
It's almost as if, Robert, there's something, there is a secret they don't want us to know.
You know,
because nothing else makes sense.
Well, if you know the people like I know them.
And I don't.
Yeah. Well, what it is, you know, with all these things. I mean, look, if I ask your listeners how many Egyptologists do they know, I think a lot of people would say Howard Carter because he found the Tutankhamun tomb. Some may say Zahi Hawass. Maybe Mark Lehner, but that's about it.
Right. Maybe John Anthony West, I guess.
Yeah,
you could call
not,
him one.
You know, a professional Egyptologist. I mean, John is like me. He's an Egyptologist from the outside.
Okay.
So that's it. And yet there are thousands of Egyptologists working today, and there has been thousands of them in previous generations. So it's one of those things, you know, few have made it in the history books. And the dream of all Egyptologists, as much as they will deny it, is to find something. And to find something in the Great Pyramid is the ultimate prize. I mean, that's it. I mean, if you're the Egyptologist who finds a secret chamber or a statue or whatever, your name is there for eternity.
Yes.
So there was no way the one let Rudolf Ganterbeck get that glory. I mean, I'm sure they will deny it.
It could have been an empty chamber.
Well, it could have been an empty chamber. I'll tell you about this empty chamber business because, as you can imagine, Rudolf Ganterbeck for months tortured himself saying, well, you know, Robert, what if there's nothing? You know, what if there's nothing?
That's right.
You know? And I would say, you know what? The whole Western culture that we exist, and even you in the States, is based on a chamber that had nothing in it. And you know what I'm talking about. When they opened the tomb of Jesus, they found nothing.
Yeah.
And suddenly the mystery takes hold. You know, what happened to the body? Why is there nothing?
What was in there?
What was in there? There you are. So the question would loom even bigger. You know, what was in there? I mean, so these are the issues. And it boggles the mind. And to have waited 15 years, and still we don't know when they're going to open this door, is to me the strangest of things. I mean, I cannot possibly imagine that they're so disinterested, so unaffected by this. So that's the problem that we're facing today, and people constantly ask me, why the delay? I mean, why aren't we looking under the Sphinx? Why? Even if we're wrong, let's find out.
Robert, when we come back, I want to get your take on the Hall of Records, what you think might be there. We'll talk about the Egypt code. What is that code? And we'll also take phone calls now with Robert Bavall. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.